Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. This is the latest in a series connected to the Threat Horizon 2024 report. My name is Mark Ward, and I worked on that report, and I'm a senior analyst at the ISF. And in this podcast, we're talking about what didn't appear in Threat Horizon, the ideas we considered, but which, for one reason or another, just didn't make it. Also here is Paul Watts, a former CISO, distinguished ISF analyst and co-writer on Threat Horizon 2024. Hello, Paul.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm not bad. And we're also joined by Richard Absalom, a principal analyst at the ISF, who helped us a lot behind the scenes with reviewing, editing of the report. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Mark. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. So those ideas then. Just to dive straight in, one of the first ones we looked at, but which didn't make it, was space. Something that, as Douglas Adams observed, is really, really big. And that's why we kind of picked it as a potential candidate, just because there was so much happening in that space. There's going to be a massive growth of satellites over the next few years. I think sort of 60,000 potentially launched. Private space companies are taking off a whole. There's potential return to the moon next couple of years. And all of that activity is likely to kick off a real growth in cheap broadband connections all over the globe, relatively high speed, satellite access get easier, launch costs drop. And that, because a lot of ISF member companies use space resources in one way or another, it seemed like something there would kind of turn up to cause problems. Just as one that is an obvious one that might catch people out is the problem with orbital debris. Obviously, every time you launch a satellite, every time you put a rocket into orbit, bits of stuff fall off that rocket or get left behind, and that goes into orbit and can crash into other things that are there. And there is a quite well-known phenomenon called the Kessler Cascade, which suggests that at some point it's going to get impossible to launch things into orbit because you'll bump into all the things that are there already. And there are some suggestions that's already started, and the number one thing satellite launch companies have to worry about these days is how much stuff is in orbit, how much is in the way of the path they want to follow to get that satellite into orbit. But it just didn't make it. We couldn't lock it down to a single threat. It was just very diffuse. I'm right in thinking that, Paul, isn't it? It just didn't quite land, if that's the phrase we want to use.
It was an interesting one, because we were actually quite excited about it. And, the early research we did, it all kind of centered around the deregulation of space. So you've got a little bit of a space race happening in low Earth orbit. There's a lot of assets being dropped into there. It's a largely deregulated area. And we prophesized on what the likely failure modes would be of low Earth orbit, be it orbital debris or something more sinister than that. But when we sounded out members on it, they couldn't really make the correlation to their worlds. So, I guess the question that kind of sits around that is, do we consider space to be critical national infrastructure? And do we understand the dependencies that our organizations may well have on space assets? So, for that reason, nobody disagreed that it wasn't a potential longer term threat, but I don't think anybody could kind of bring it back to their world. And that's why we dropped it on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, I think so, because there was a lot of people, we did quiz quite a lot of ISF members about it, and a lot of them used the incredibly accurate clocks you get for GPS and for all kinds of things and resolution of trading and lots of very complicated finance hangs on a lot of those timing signals and things. But that combination of, like I say, critical infrastructure on the one hand and then wildly deregulated, unregulated on the other, it just seemed like a perfect place for one of those big threats to emerge. But we just couldn't see it. I mean, maybe we were just missing something, but is that probably right, Rich? And just sort of, just couldn't characterize what the big threat would be.
Yeah, I mean, as someone on the review team and therefore official buzzkill to the excitement that you guys had about that on the first threat, I mean, and Paul, I know, hates me for saying this, but we've kind of done it before to a certain extent.
Saying that.
Part of that, what we're trying to do with Threat Horizon is come up with new stuff every year. So when we've looked at it to a certain extent, I think it was Threat Horizon 2020, we looked at more specifically malicious attacks on satellites in order to do things like disrupt GPS and those clocks that you're talking about that kind of make financial systems run on time. Yeah, so trying to kind of develop that and find that bigger threat that we hadn't kind of touched on previously or make it a bit different was possibly part of that reason. You know, we couldn't find that kind of one single threat that you're talking about that would impact lots of different organizations.
No, that's not to say there isn't a lot happening. As
with a lot of things, as with a lot of things on Threat Horizon, there's loads of things going on that are a threat that aren't necessarily brand new. That makes it difficult for us to kind of include them sometimes.
Yeah, and I think our planning wasn't helped by Russia smashing up satellites in orbit, and it was just like, what the hell's going to happen as a result of that? But again, something that didn't thankfully cause more problems than did cause a lot of problems, but not quite so many as we expected.
My fear with the space threat is we're probably going to need an event for everybody to sit bolt upright and go, damn, that is a threat vector, and we never really thought about it. Now what do we do? So, you know, whilst we've, you know, I have to concede Rich's point, you know, we've done it before and we try to break convention and look at new things with Threat Horizon. You know, there is going to be the occasional opportunity where something circles back round and we have to put it back on the table and say, you know, the world's changed. This is something we need to be discussing. It just didn't really fit with the structure of Threat Horizon, but I did find it quite interesting that, you know, everybody kind of acknowledged it was there, but kind of acknowledged they didn't really understand the relationship. And I think it's going to take, you know, destabilization of a low Earth orbit asset or even a middle Earth orbit asset like GPS for people to realize the dependency that they've got on that environment. But by then it will be a little bit too late. And, you know, Threat Horizon is all about trying to predict the future. So interesting one, I think. It's going to come back, Rich, I'm afraid. I can see it coming back in the future.
I have no doubt. And frankly, we got the 2021 wrong anyway, and to the extent that we probably got it a bit early in terms of things that are actually happening.
Yeah, but that's true with a lot of Threat Horizon threats, is that the way we think they will emerge or manifest is not quite the way they do. And, you know, the consequences of that are often something we don't explore quite in the same way. But one thing we have done with space is that we have done a bit more work on it. And I think what makes it interesting and perhaps intriguing and why we pursued it was just there are some wildly different outcomes depending on what happens. Just that it could be great because there's lots of startups, there's a couple of startups trying to solve that orbital debris problem. And if they do, and those commercial space launches go do well, then we could be entering our golden age of space exploration. However, if we get the Kessler-Cascade does catches out and that space orbital debris grows, then we're at the other end of that spectrum. So yeah, I think it's one to watch, I hope, but nothing quite for the 2024 report, unfortunately.
And still no sign of any Martians, so you know.
No, but I think there's another thing that seems to have happened as well, is just there's a lot more people looking for aliens as well, and there's signals being beamed into space, and there's all kinds of stuff going on there. It's just fascinating when the fanboy me goes, "Woo, look, space!" I really like that as a thing to explore. Again, my wanting to do that was not answered by the actual threats.
Look, we tried to get it into you, Mark. We tried to appeal to the Trekkies in the room, and we just couldn't make it land, and we just have to accept it and move on. Yeah. But I think I do think it will come back. I think that interrelationship between organisations and space assets is probably more defined than people give credit for. So watch this space. I think we're going to come back to this one.
Yeah. And speaking of moving on, I think the next one we looked at for quite a while again was the metaverse. I don't know, Paul, you can talk briefly about what the heck that is.
You see, so I've got an Oculus. I don't know whether you guys have got an Oculus. And I sit, you know, occasionally I will pick it up, dust it off, charge it up, put it on my head, have a bit of a play, try the virtual desktops and try the kind of social interactions. And I think, okay, but I still think it's a bit of a solution looking for a problem. That said, this comes back around and around and around over and over and over again. And clearly the tech companies are interested in this. They think it's the next big thing. It's the future. And they want to invest. They're throwing a fortune at it. Obviously, we saw Facebook transform to Meta. Zuckerberg's really pushing his forward strategy for the metaverse. And, you know, people are jumping on the bandwagon. But and our members tended to agree with us, this still feels like a solution looking for a problem. There are a number of blockers that we need to get past. Cost of hardware being one, which, you know, now we've got semiconductor shortages, that problem's now compounded, probably pushes it further out to the right. Connectivity was an issue as well, but we're now starting to see the acceleration of 5G deployment and faster Wi-Fi, faster broadbanded internet to domestic premises. So, you know, maybe that's starting to move out of the way. But I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I still can't quite see it as a 2024 threat, and that's why it hit the cutting room floor. What do you think?
Yeah, I've got a Gear VR, and I've messed around with that, and it's certainly the cruder end of VR. But it's there's occasional things I've watched in it, but yeah, mine's very much gathering dust. I can't remember the last time I used it, to be honest. And I think with this, it just again, it seems like, is it a good idea to have meetings in VR? I'd probably not. And just I think as well the other problems it brings with it. It's not just the fact that you have to wear a headset. There's just the environment you're creating, that everything is made of code, and just, you know, that's going to go wrong because you're going to have third party code. You're going to have, how are you going to do? There's all kinds of issues that start to crop up if everything you touch, everything you interact with is code.
I think it comes back to the issue with hardware. You know, I mean, I've spent 12, 13 hours a day on back-to-back Teams calls, and my eyesight has not forgiven me for that, although I'm not getting any younger, so I have to kind of acknowledge that as well. But, you know, taking that a step further and expecting everybody to live with, you know, headsets on their heads, which are very heavy, you know. I mean, you wear an Oculus for anything longer than an hour. I mean, that's a painful thing.
It seems to me like it's one that's potentially, you know, a bit further out than the horizon we're looking at in that 2 or 3 years time frame. I don't think it's something that's necessarily going to go away. And when all the big tech companies are chucking money at something, that I don't want to generally say they're onto something, but they tend to make it work by hook or by crook. I just wonder, yeah, in terms of the use case on this, everyone's all with like Google Glass. Right, just didn't go down well in the public, and that's the lightweight version. So if you don't want to walk around with an Oculus on your head, well, the alternative is a pair of normal looking glasses, but then that really creeps people out. So I don't think the world's ready for that kind of thing yet. And you know, while there are niche use cases, it's probably not enough to impact most organizations.
Well, those people got a name, didn't they? They were called glassholes.
I was trying not to say that, Paul, but yeah.
That's the reality. You know, people see it as a form of clandestine surveillance, so they're not bought into it yet. So to take that and scale it into the metaverse, I'm still not quite sure that mainstream consumers will buy in just yet.
No. Well, I think certainly the some of the early shared worlds have had a huge problem with harassment. I think, you know, any female player gamer who's online, and people know they're online, they just get, it's just horrible the kind of treatment that they can get in all kinds of very popular games. And that's just gonna be so much worse when you can physically see who people are. And I just can't see that. I mean, Facebook notoriously good at solving those kind of problems, or maybe not. So I just can't see that happening. And I think as well, what because the idea of the metaverse, the meta in metaverse means across all of them. But at the moment, there's lots of different types of things emerging. There's Facebook obviously building its own platform, Epic as well, more on the gaming side. And then you've got the NFT and crypto bros who are trying to do it a different way. And then you've got maybe established worlds like Minecraft and all kinds of things like that as well. So it's just a bit of a mess at the moment, I think. And I just can't see any common platform emerging that will unite that and get us hopping merrily through all those virtual worlds.
You make an interesting point, actually. You know, where they say possession is 9/10 of the law. You know, how do you determine possession of digital assets in the metaverse? And that's probably where things like non-fungible tokens have a place. Although at the moment, it still feels a bit faddy and fashionista, but the concept is sound. I think it just needs to grow up a little bit. You know, back to your earlier point, you know, we're only just as a society coming to grips with the how to conduct yourself in a appropriate way in a social media space. Now, if you take that a step further forward, you're absolutely right. You know, people have got to have that adjustment. I recall there's a, I won't name the platform, but it runs on the Oculus platform where you can sit in a virtual theater and throw popcorn at each other, and that's great. But somebody can come and sidle up next to you and basically be really in your face. And that's actually quite intimidating. And I think Oculus or the provider of this software released a patch so that you can actually stop somebody getting in your private space. But what is your private space in the metaverse? We've got to navigate all of these things. So I think in the short term, there'll be some very niche applications for metaverse technology. But I think before it becomes mainstream, there are some social, moral, ethical hurdles that need to be overcome. And that's before we even start talking about the security and privacy implications of such a platform.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are very worried about what happens with phishing type scams in virtual worlds, because the body language of your avatar might be crude, but it'd still be more convincing than an email. So I think, yeah, it would be interesting to see that. And then copyright as well, how you're going to handle that. Because I remember, a long time ago, 2003, I think it launched Second Life, which was supposed to be the start of all this kind of stuff. And that had some terrible lessons for how not to do this. I think there was a griefer called Granny that looked like an old woman that you're supposed to help as soon as you landed in one of the starting zones for Second Life. And then as soon as you interacted, they just turned into this monster who just gave you a hard time and flogged you around all day and ruined your early experience. And it's just like, you know, that type of thing is going to happen. So I think, yeah, those are the sort of things that we have to try and, like you say, learn to cope with, not do. I don't know. It's a hard one.
I was going to ask
if hard lessons to learn.
Yeah, I was going to ask if Second Life was still going. Yeah, apparently it is. But yeah, lots of lessons to learn. The other thing that Paul mentioned there, and I wanted to follow up on, was the NFT side in terms of, you know, kind of understanding who pays for what, who owns what, where's the copyright. And it seems to me, maybe it's the Luddite in me talking, but yeah, there's a long way to go for those to become, you know, really popular. There's a lot of backlash, right? Especially just in the environmental terms, just the environmental cost of attaching an NFT to every digital asset, and kind of what's the point of it in the end? The football fan in me sees all these clubs releasing essentially Panini stickers, backed up by, you know, but they're limited by NFTs. You're like, well, why would I pay that much? Well, you could say the same for Panini stickers.
And people are struggling to find their way with it. So, yeah. You know, I may not have this 100% right, but I recall that Jack Dorsey's first tweet was sold as an NFT for a considerable sum of money. And I think they're trying to resale that. Oh, yeah. And the value has plummeted. I still don't think people are quite get it.
No. I think because there's a lot of scams going on, a lot of rug pulls, and people who buy their own NFTs to boost the price and then step away when other people think, oh my god, it's going up in price. So I think that, yeah, there's a lot of ethics around that, and just, yeah, how do you set up a system that is hard to abuse and yet preserves those copyrights and things? So yeah, and we've been wrestling with that on the internet for a long time.
Use up a huge amount of power in the meantime.
Well, exactly. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the other, yeah, like I say, behind the scenes, all the hardware toiling away and burning, you know, as much power just to keep your headset going all the time.
Never mind that. Imagine being that guy that gets catfished by the first virtual Tinder experience in the metaverse. I mean, you know.
Yes, there's some, yeah, horror stories, unfortunately, to be written.
So we're writing this one off, basically.
But I think you're right, Richard. Yeah, but I think the timeline was just off for it. And despite Facebook transforming into Meta, I'd be interested to see how that plays out. But just to move things on, I think, Rich, one we really looked at a lot, and you know, you spent a lot of time considering, is supply chain. And just, I think, I'm sure there's been questions by ISF members about, why didn't that appear? Because, you know, they're having all kinds of problems with their supply chains right now.
Yeah, very good questions. And again, the reason is a lot of the things we were talking about or trying to, you know, think through in terms of what the supply chain attacks look like are pretty much already happening. And you know, so this is not to say it's not in threat horizon, because it's not an issue. The problem is it's an issue right now, and we know people are dealing with it, especially if you look at software attacks. So, you know, all the recent or relatively recent examples around SolarWinds, Microsoft, Okta, you know, these kind of the companies that have the keys to the kingdom for thousands and thousands of customers are being targeted and are kind of a nice route through for attackers. So yeah, trying to work out how that might change in the next couple of years is quite difficult, because, you know, it's a bit like ransomware. You know, we're gradually seeing an evolution that was obviously covered in the report. But, you know, if attackers are onto a good business model and a certain way of, you know, doing things, they're not necessarily going to change that model in the short term. Could I follow
that? I completely agree. I mean, we're here right now. And I think industry and enterprise has had a bit of a wake-up call that actually you know, the old adage is you're only as strong as your weakest link. That weakest link was never before really kind of thought about in the context of supply chain. I guess where it could have made the cut for 2024 is just the concept of the sprawl. You know, more and more organizations are leveraging cloud environments, cloud infrastructure. A lot of organizations now completely within the cloud. As we talk about in the threat with cloud hostages, so some saving grace we have kind of insinuated this is you lose control. So if you think about that loss of control and then think about that in the context of supply chain risk, you know, how do you know where the dangers are if you don't understand, you know, the behaviors of the suppliers who are providing not just services, but actually core infrastructure that powers your business? So I think we're there.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously, so I haven't worked on the supply chain research, you know, starting in 2020. That's, you know, we're pretty much looking at similar problems then. Those were the things that were coming up. People were moving all into the cloud. Yeah, trying to deal with that, it becoming, you know, ever increasingly popular topic or something that people are more worried about. So yeah, just trying to work out, yeah, what that looks like is a bit messy. But obviously, it's a huge challenge right now.
You see, again, coming back to the concept of space, you know, we said it might take a notable event to make business sit up and take notice of the threat, it being an actuality rather than a perception of a threat. And I think SolarWinds probably being the first and the biggest was that wake-up call. I think we're going to see more and more of those. And, you know, that understanding of that supply chain risk is a hot topic. I mean, it's getting talked about a lot through 2022.
Yeah, I think we did consider it pretty seriously because of SolarWinds and those other systemic attacks, and just that, you know, are the bad guys going to pivot to that? But they kind of already have, and like you say, Rich, it just seems to be a reality for organisations these days. But I have seen some slight tweaks, I don't know if that's the word, or quirks to it, which are certainly with respect of open source code, because some of developers are using their code as a way to protest. They're either putting comments in that, or sort of geographically restricting it. And that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because that, you know, as you would imagine as well, Russian developers might do that. And a lot of developers now are freelance, so they're just working on particular projects. So, I mean, maybe that could be an issue. But again, I imagine it's the type of thing organizations have to contend with anyway. So it's not like it's a new threat. And again, that's what nixed it for me. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's potentially a different motivation, but is the outcome still the same? Essentially, you're still using potentially, you know, insecure software. So it's however it becomes insecure is, well, it depends how semantically whether you care that much or whether it's the impact that is most important.
I think you make an interesting point, actually. So Russia-Ukraine wasn't something that we were really thinking about in the context of Threat Horizon 2024 when we wrote and published the report. But if we do see geographical or geopolitical fault lines start to widen as a consequence of, you know, events like that, what are the ramifications of that on supply chain risk? And how do those fault lines impact and affect the way that, you know, the digital world operates? I think that's a fascinating topic and something that, you know, we may well come back to in future iterations of Threat Horizon.
Yeah, I mean, just to defend the report a bit, I mean, we did call out in the front of the report with the PESL section just about the ongoing turmoil, and certainly to expect that. And I think in the conclusion we wrapped up and said, yeah, no one expects anything to be a world of peace and harmony over the next few years. So I think we did acknowledge that, and certainly I think on the supply chains, yeah, they're just going to get more and more fractured, and it's going to get harder and harder to maintain that seamless system in the future.
It further amplifies the closing comments of the Threat Horizon summary, which is, you know, the model of trust being, you know, being pretty shattered and fragmented now. I think that's further amplified by further geopolitical rifts.
Yeah, I think with it's the working in information security is rarely a time of light and happiness. So I think just the report is, yeah, but we're talking about the disintegration of trust and the problems that are just organizations going to have to cope with. Yeah, just different ways to, you know, we say you can't depend on what you used to depend on, to find different ways to be sure, to reassure yourself and assure yourself in all kinds of ways that things are operating as you expect and as you want. It's not getting easier, are they?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we've often as technologists defended the importance of the internet conceptually remaining open, free and globalized, but that's not in confluence with, you know, with turmoil that you have at a geopolitical level, you know, and you know, if things continue down that plane, does the whole concept of open and interoperability start to become challenged? You know, I think that's a fascinating topic of conversation, probably way outside this conversation, but it's not something that's going to go away anytime soon.
No, I think that's definitely the reality that quarters out between 2023 and 2024 is just that we thought the pandemic would be over after a certain amount of time, and there could be some certainties you'd return to, but now definitely not. We don't see that at all. I mean, a slightly grim message, but again, I'd certainly on the supply chain side, Rich, I just wonder, I mean, obviously we've got some good advice out there. So it's not like it's hopeless. I mean, there are ways to improve, you know, to get a handle on what's going on and, you know, keep things running.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's always got to be a way of approaching things, and prioritizing and understanding where your greatest risk is obviously the key way to start. And so obviously the ISF's got a lot of research out there. And to be honest, the concepts that we started talking about back in 2013, you know, way before my time even, looking at those, it still makes sense. You know, the world has sped up. You've probably got more suppliers than you used to, the clouds around, but essentially it's still all about understanding where the biggest likely risk is and putting resources in there, because we know everyone's pretty much strapped for resources and time, and you've got thousands and thousands of suppliers, you can't deal with all of them. The key is understanding, okay, where are we going to place most of our efforts in terms of securing and kind of monitoring those suppliers. And then frankly, you know, at some point it's a question of when rather than if, right? There's going to be attacks, so then it becomes about building resilience. How do you know when an incident happens, and how do you respond to it, become the important things to think about.
Indeed. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everybody else, for listening as well. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn about more about ISF research tools and guidance.